Welcome to Lungcast, the monthly respiratory health podcast series from the American Lung Association and medical news site HCP Live. I'm your host, Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Before we introduce our guest today, just a reminder that Lungcast is available on all your favorite streaming platforms. Subscribe to @Lungcast on YouTube to get new and archived episodes, as well as interview segments and episode highlights as they come out. A link to the show page, as well as the American Lung Association and hcplive.com homepages for Lungcast, can be found in each episode description. For those of you who prefer a podcast, you can subscribe at Lungcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and your favorite listening platforms. You can also register for more respiratory news and insights at both lung.org and hcplive.com. Our guest today is Dr. Stephanie Levinsky-Desir, who is Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Environmental Health Sciences and the Director of the Pediatric Pulmonary Division at Columbia University Irving Medical Center in New York City. Her research is focused on understanding how environmental factors impact children with asthma, particularly in urban and minority communities. Her multidisciplinary approach to studying urban environmental asthma has led to fruitful collaborations throughout several schools at Columbia, including the School of Medicine, the School of Public Health, the School of Nursing, and the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. And importantly, Dr. Levinsky-Desir is a volunteer national spokesperson for the American Lung Association, and we thank her for her contribution of time and expertise. And I could not think of a more ideal guest for today's Lungcast, since May is National Asthma and Allergy Awareness Month. Dr. Levinsky-Desir, thank you for joining me today to discuss several aspects of asthma care.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm absolutely delighted to speak with you today.
So before we speak about certain aspects of care, I wanted to have a level setting for our audience about some terms that are used to classify asthma. And these would include things like endotypes, phenotypes, allergic, eosinophilic, and then more recently, T2 and non-T2 asthma. Can you give us a brief overview of these terms and how knowing what these terms mean may help in management decisions?
Yes, of course. I think it's funny when you talk to a bunch of pulmonologists about asthma, one of the things that we uncover, we kind of tell ourselves is there's so much unknown about asthma. And I think all of these terms are our way of sort of unpacking different aspects of asthma management, asthma care, and sort of getting a better understanding of what asthma is. Because I think honestly, you know, asthma might be a number of different diseases that manifest with similar presentations, and we kind of lump it all together under this umbrella term asthma. So the first two terms you use about endotypes versus phenotype, I think that's one way of teasing out a phenotype, meaning how does this disease present itself to the external person? What does it look like? What are the signs and symptoms that we're seeing? As opposed to an endotype, which is getting more at the basis of what do we think are the underlying causes of this particular type of asthma. So phenotypes of asthma might be exercise-induced asthma or allergic asthma or obesity-associated asthma, whereas endotypes get more at what are the root causes or what's underlying these. So when you think about things like eosinophilic or allergic, T2 or non-T2, those are getting at more of the body's allergic response to allergens, to environmental insults, and that manifests as this outward phenotype or outward projection of asthma. So T2 tends to refer more to the allergic type of asthma. So that means that inflammatory cells that are part of the allergic pathway, like eosinophils, might be increased or elevated in T2 type asthma or allergic asthma. Whereas other non-T2, like asthma associated with obesity, may not have as high eosinophil levels or total IgE levels. And I think what's important as we try to unpack or understand more about what's causing asthma, the reason why these terms are very relevant is because it helps us to determine which types of treatments might work for your asthma. And I think we'll sort of talk about that a little bit more, but the idea of which pathway are we actually trying to target with the types of medications that we're using for asthma.
So the first topic I'd like to discuss with you today is SMART, or single maintenance and reliever therapy. Now, we know in 2020, the National Asthma Education and Prevention Program published a focused update to their asthma guidelines for U.S. clinicians, and that preferentially recommended the use of a combination inhaled corticosteroid for motor inhaler for both maintenance and quick symptom relief, or the acronym SMART. I think in general, this has led to a little bit of a paradigm shift in asthma therapy with the emergence of these treatment strategies that incorporate the use of inhaled steroids within relievers for their asthma symptoms. This is called anti-inflammatory reliever therapies, or AIR. An article in this past February's Chest Journal talks about these strategies that include SMART, another acronym PARTIX, meaning patient-activated reliever-triggered inhaled corticosteroids, and then the use of a more recent combination, single SABA and inhaled corticosteroid combination. Could you help us sort this out and explain these terms, and most importantly, the rationale behind them and how they may be used in playing out in practice for the physicians and the patients? I'm particularly interested in your observations on some barriers to implementing these types of approaches.
Yes, I love that you use the term paradigm shifting, because that's exactly how I think of where we are moving in terms of this type of medication and treatment for asthma. You know, when I was coming up in training in residency and in fellowship training, we were so rigid about this mantra that an inhaled steroid should be only used as a controller medication to help control your asthma symptoms or control the inflammation in the airways, whereas the rescue medication or the reliever medication was the short-acting beta agonist. And we very much stuck to this idea of like, this type of medication can only be used on an everyday as like a maintenance, and another medication that should be used when you're sick. And we've kind of blown that up now with the SMART therapy. And I think the rationale behind this is that, you know, when an individual has a full-blown asthma exacerbation that is not well controlled, or an asthma attack that is not well controlled with their rescue medication, or what we typically think of as a short-acting beta agonist, then ultimately they may go on to having systemic steroids, or steroids that either gets injected or that they take orally. And those are much higher doses of steroids, and those have the side effects and the risk profile of, you know, systemic absorption. And, you know, I think that the rationale and the studies that have supported these new recommendations suggest that by giving an inhaled steroid alongside the short-acting beta agonist, or sometimes a long-acting beta agonist, as with these combined medications, that that inhaled steroid dose actually might be enough to help control those acute symptoms of asthma. And so this is where we get into this space where we're using therapies that we can use for maintenance or treatment control. That's the inhaled corticosteroid combined with the long-acting beta agonist that's often used in SMART therapy. Usually we're preferentially using the long-acting beta agonist formoterol because it has a rapid onset of action within that first hour. And so we're seeing now that these medications can be used to help help control these acute symptoms of asthma and potentially prevent the need for going on systemic steroids and having to deal with the side effects. And so all of those terms that you referred to and all of those medications that you referred to essentially have some component of them where you're using an inhaled steroid at the same time that you're using either a short or a long-acting beta agonist to relieve the acute symptoms of asthma. This has been tricky to implement, though. I will be honest with you.
Yes,
and I can
has.
Tell you, I don't know if it's trickier for me as a pediatrician who deals with, you know, little people and their parents. But, you know, three things sort of come to mind in terms of my challenges that I've encountered in my clinical practice in implementing this therapy. First of all, you know, we've been saying the same thing over and over and over again, as I mentioned, this mantra, this you use for this and this use. And so trying to unpack that and get people to recognize that, like, oh, maybe there are different approaches, I feel like has been a little bit tricky. I've had several patients who have said, you know, but my albuterol works. When I'm not feeling well, the albuterol works, so why would I do something different? So that's been one piece of it. And alongside the idea, I think, of the single maintenance and rescue therapy is that you should be able to use only one pump that you can use for both this maintenance therapy and the rescue therapy. But the tricky part, particularly for our pediatric patients, is that there are thresholds in terms of how many inhalations you should be able to use in a day. So that's the second thing that I find tricky, is trying to describe to families and patients that, okay, if you're less than 12 years old, no more than 8 inhalations of this medication in a 24-hour period. If that doesn't work, then you have to switch over to your albuterol. If you're older than 12, no more than 12 inhalations. And for some people, just trying to wrap your head around keeping track of how many inhalations, I think, can be tricky. You know, the studies that have supported the use of smart therapy have pointed out that oftentimes you don't need to go up to those higher thresholds to be able to control treatment. But when you're first explaining this to families, it can be tricky. And then the third area that I think has been challenging is honestly getting the medication approved by insurance companies. So if you're using an inhaler, 2 puffs in the morning, 2 puffs at night for maintenance, and then you're going to use it on top of that for, you know, to relieve acute symptoms, you're going to run out before a month is over. And so we've had to be tricky and sort of creative about how do we prescribe the medication in such a way that people will have enough at home. So that's been sort of the third challenge, is getting insurance companies on board. Absolutely. Sometimes allowing an individual to get 2 pumps at the same time.
And I want to add another challenge. And, you know, habits are hard to break among physicians. I'm just curious about your pulmonary and allergy colleagues as to how well they're starting to transition to this new paradigm, or are they holding back a bit?
Yeah, I've been, I feel like I've been on a speaking tour across many different areas in our hospital system. I think with the pulmonologist, it's probably a little bit easier. We have more time to focus on this. We have a little bit more comfort with using these combined medications. With my hospitalist colleagues and my general pediatricians, I think it's a little bit more challenging. And I think it's these nuances between like how many puffs, how many times, when do you tell them to increase? When do you tell them to switch over to their, you know, short acting beta agonists? I think all of these are things we have to kind of overcome over time.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. So I wanted to switch gears a little bit. The emergence of biologic therapies for the management of asthma has been seen as a revolutionary change and our ability to manage the disease. Omalizumab, the first humanized anti-IgE monoclonal antibody, was authorized for use in patients by the US FDA back in 2003. And more recently, there's been anti-IL-5 biologics, mepolizumab, rizolizumab, benralizumab, and anti-IL-4/13, dupilumab. And they've been approved for the treatment of asthma, as well as the antithymic stromal lymphoprotein. So a mouthful of these, this tezimelumab. And all of these are for different age levels as far as availability. Now, there are other biologics, anti-IL-17, anti-IL-25, anti-IL-33, they're all on the pipeline. And it suggests that we're going to see several more monoclonal antibodies targeting different pathways that you mentioned earlier in our discussion that may be expected in the next coming years. So what guidance could you offer on several aspects of biologic use in pediatric asthma? Like, who is the right candidate? How do you select the right biologic? And how long do you wait to see if it's been beneficial before thinking about switching to other biologics?
Yeah, this is great. I will say, you know, I feel like in my lifetime, in my career, I've actually seen this flourishing of all of these new medications that have now become available to help manage children and adults with severe asthma. And it's exciting, I think, you know, the idea that there can be medications given that can actually reduce the frequency of an individual having to come to the emergency room or be hospitalized or have severe outcomes associated with asthma it's been wonderful. The one thing I will say is most of these target the T2 pathway. So most of them are focusing on allergic asthma. And I don't think there's as much out there that for targeting those with non-T2 asthma. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, we know that T2 asthma or allergic asthma, particularly for our pediatric patients, is the majority. And we see at least 2/3 of our patients who have allergic asthma. So, you know, who does this work for? Well, if there's a child or an adult who's just not responding well to an inhaled steroid or an inhaled steroid plus a long-acting beta agonist, and they've been on that medication for a while, you know, that would be the time that you might consider stepping up to using a biologic. And actually, the GINA guidelines actually have it listed now in their more recent guidelines as step five therapy for once you've made it across all of those steps of increasing your other inhaler medications. And we use our blood tests to help us identify. So, you know, some of these work best in individuals who have high eosinophil counts. Others like omalizumab, as you mentioned, which was one of the first ones out there on the market for asthma, works best if you have an elevated total IgE. So there are algorithms that are available to help determine based on, you know, what blood tests you have available to see which one might be the best fit or might work best. There's always some overlap and crosstalk there. Mm-hmm. The other thing you sort of alluded to is the different age ranges. So they're not all approved for use in the youngest children. Omalizumab, dupilumab, benralizumab, those are all available for children six and above. The others are either 12 and above or 18 and above. And so that's also kind of weighs into the discussion or the decision-making process around which biologic to use based on which one is approved. Although I will also say that some of them, like dupilumab, have other indications that might allow them to be used in children even younger than 6 years of age. Dosing frequency is another piece of it. So, you know, if a child is going to get an injection every 2 weeks versus every 4 weeks or every 8 weeks, that weighs into which one we might determine. The nice thing is that, you know, back in the day, omalizumab had to be had to be injected in the office, you know, every 4 weeks or 2 weeks, and you had to have a visit. Now, so many of these, all of them basically are available in auto injectors or pre-filled syringes that individuals can give at home, administer at home. So I think that after they've demonstrated that they don't have an allergic reaction in the office, I think it's been really wonderful option to be able to use these medications at home. And then typically I like to see, you know, a patient on a biologic for at least 3 or 4 months and like determine based on lung nitric oxide and other symptoms, you know, if it's really not working and we've noticed no change or worsening, we might consider after about 3 to 4 months switching, maybe give it as long as 6 months to determine if there's a good effect or if we might need to switch over for another. So the nice thing is now we have options. So we can potentially switch to a different biologic and see if that might work better for the child family.
So in keeping with this discussion on the biologics, there are some researchers and clinicians who wonder if the use of these biologics earlier in the disease process could interrupt pathways in the allergic asthma march and be used almost as a modifying agent, act as a preventive measure in halting the development of more severe asthma. I've noticed there was a study, PARK, P-A-R-K trial, discussed in Contemporary Clinical Trials back in January of 2021 that it's getting started, looking at the role of omalizumab in this setting, for example. So you can share some thoughts on that.
Yeah, this is a tricky one because it's always hard to comment on a study that hasn't actually been completed yet. And some of the things I think about that weigh into that, you know, I think that PARK trial that you mentioned, they're looking at using omalizumab in children as young as 2 and 3 years of age. And so, you know, I'm curious to see how does their recruitment for that kind of study, especially if a child is doesn't have, you know, symptoms of severe asthma. I completely am supportive of the idea of trying preventative measures to reduce the severity and incidence even of asthma. I just think sometimes that's a little harder to accomplish, particularly in the very young. So I think it's a wonderful idea. I can't weigh in too much more beyond that, just because,
absolutely,
you know, those barriers to conducting such a study also have to weigh into whether or not it's actually practical to have that sort of intervention in real life.
So more information in the future.
Yes, hopefully, yes.
You had an article published in the Journal of Allergy and Immunology back in November of 2020. And this was regarding your experience with COVID-19 in asthma patients. During the years of the pandemic, the literature had some conflicting reports about the risk of asthma patients and the severity of COVID-19 and outcomes. Could you tell us about your experience and what the science tells us now about the interaction of COVID-19 and asthma?
Yes, I think, at the start of the pandemic in the winter and spring of 2020, I think pulmonologists like myself were very worried. We know that, especially for children, one of the risk factors or triggers, I should say, for an asthma attack or an asthma exacerbation is a respiratory viral infection. We see this all the time, right? We know that in the fall, once kids go back to school, that's when we see the highest rates of emergency department visits. So here's this virus that's actually killing people. And we thought, like, oh my goodness, what is this going to mean for our pediatric patients? So that was the motivation to look at data. Of course, I'm in New York City, where we got hit super hard with COVID. So we had many, many cases to draw from. And we looked at our patients who were hospitalized, and we compared those who had asthma versus those who did not have asthma to try to understand, did we see worse outcomes, greater intubations, greater morbidity? And we didn't. And, you know, our findings were similar to what was observed in other reports across New York City, but also across the country. And I don't think we fully understand why it is that COVID-19 in particular did not impart a greater risk in individuals who had asthma, underlying asthma versus not. But I do think that it's important that we were able to use sort of this experiment of what was happening in real time in front of us to kind of use that data to help support and actually counsel our patients and our families, because they too were terrified. You know, we've since published another paper where we talked about the lessons learned from the pandemic. And I think even though we didn't see significantly worse outcomes among those who had asthma, I think we learned a lot from the pandemic that we can use to help improve that overall asthma outcomes. Things like hand washing and wearing masks during respiratory viral season. These are all things that we started doing during the pandemic that actually probably helped to reduce the risk of asthma exacerbations. I think, you know, telehealth was a big thing that came out of the pandemic that I think we've been using and finding opportunities to use that to our advantage nowadays, you know. So I think there are certainly lessons learned for individuals during who have asthma that we can benefit from. Sorry, one more thing I just thought of is, you know, improving air quality, right? And all of the efforts that we're going towards, like in schools and classrooms, thinking about how do we make sure the air quality indoors is appropriate enough that we're not creating environments where we're spreading more viruses. So, you know, I think COVID has taught us a ton that can be very useful, I think, for particularly taking care of children with asthma.
I wanted to move away from the virus talk and go to another area of research that you're involved with. And this has to do with the association of outdoor air pollution and non-viral illness as they relate to how the molecular pathways in asthma may be a good ground for research and implications for identifying how we may care for these patients with asthma a little differently. I'm referring to a work that was published in Lancet in January of 2023. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, I think this was a really interesting study that I had the that I was fortunate to be a part of, that was part of the CAUSE Network, which is a multi-center, multidisciplinary consortium of centers across the country in urban communities that's really trying to identify therapy options, as well as understand why do children who live in urban communities have greater morbidity associated with asthma. And so another thing that is a trigger of an asthma attack, as we know, is environmental air pollution exposure. So as we were just discussing, viral infections are a trigger for asthma. But in this particular paper with the CAUSE Network, this was actually a trial that was looking at, actually, we looked at a couple of two different cohorts within that consortium and found found that air pollution, exposure to high concentrations of environmental air pollution, can be a trigger of asthma exacerbations, particularly in instances where viruses were not the trigger of asthma exacerbations. So, and I think what was very elegant about this particular analysis was really looking at mechanisms and pathways that are upregulated in this response to environmental air pollution and subsequent asthma exacerbation. We've nicely laid out sort of what we see in clinical practice, which is, you know, there is an inciting event that happens that, and you start having symptoms, and then the asthma sort of follows those symptoms within about 5 days or so. And we see this happen in clinical medicine in the work that we do with our patients as well. So I think this is just like another peek into a whole nother space where, as I mentioned before, we're just trying to understand a little bit more about what mechanisms are upregulated or downregulated and which pathways are leading to what we're seeing in terms of clinical asthma outcomes. And, you know, with the hope that eventually we can identify additional therapies to help manage our patients who have asthma, much like what we've seen with the biologics.
Right. So another area of your expertise and research is inequities in asthma care. And we know back in 1993, there was the NIH Revitalization Act. And this was looked at as a landmark act for establishing guidelines to include women and underrepresented racial and ethnic minorities in clinical research. The primary goal of that act was to ensure that NIH-funded clinical research addresses the impact of sex, gender, race, and ethnicity on health and disease. And no later on, and more recently, you took part in an American Thoracic Society research statement published in 2021, looking at this aspect of minority inclusion in clinical trials. I was hoping you could give us a sense of those findings and explain the concept of community-placed research as compared to community-based participatory research that was looked at as a model in that monograph.
Yeah, that was a. It was really great to be a part of that workshop because I think historically we hear often that people from historically marginalized groups don't want to participate in research. And people always point to things like the Tuskegee trials as a reason why there's a lack of trust from Black and Brown communities in the medical system, as well as the whole enterprise of scientific research. And I think what we've tried to do with that workshop and that workshop report is to push back on that a little bit. I think there is a huge component of trust that needs to be overcome in terms of being able to actively engage with and recruit people from historically marginalized communities. And it's imperative, you know, if we are really trying to address health inequities and health disparities, we cannot conduct research, we cannot conduct these clinical trials and these new medications in a population of people who all look the same, because there are so many. Maybe there are biological factors, there are social factors, environmental factors that make these medications, these treatments, these therapies, these approaches not applicable in all different neighborhoods, communities, and environments. And so I think it's really, really important as we think about how do we address health inequities to make sure that we are including people from the communities, the neighborhoods that we are trying to help in our research. Now, you talk about community-based participatory research. There's one thing to go into a community and say, I have a great idea. Now I'm going to use you all to help me decide if that idea is going to work, versus having the community engaged in the design and the development of the study. And that can include, you know, how are we going to identify who are the individuals we want to recruit from? Who are the people in the community that can help us to identify who we should be asking to participate in these clinical trials? And even more so, what are the questions that are important to the community that we as researchers should be addressing? And so I think that's when we get more into community-based participatory research, is making sure that the community is on equal footing and that they have an equal voice in the design, the development, and the implementation of the research study. And, you know, that's tricky. I mentioned trust earlier, and that's a big piece of it, establishing relationships with communities so that they understand that, you know, what are the motives? Because that's always, what's the intention here? You know, are you studying us, or are you trying to help us address issues that are meaningful and important to us? And it's that nuance or that balance that really needs to come out if you want to do impactful and meaningful work in this area. The other challenge, I think, to that, besides the fact that it takes time and effort to build trust and build relationships with communities, is finding funding and resources to support this type of work. You know, our traditional mechanisms for grant funding are basically you design a study, then you write a proposal, and then the money is given to you so that you can carry out what that study. But it's a very different thing to build that proposal or build, take that time to understand the needs of the communities and to design a project or intervention, let's say, with the community. And so I think we really do need to think more about how do we fund this type of work. Mm-hmm. There are some opportunities that are out there, but I think if we're really going to move the needle on health equity, there needs to be more investment in this space.
So the funding agencies like NIH and, for that matter, the American Lung Association need to take that into account when we see protocols being sent to us.
Exactly, yeah. Right. And even putting out calls specifically requesting community building. Right. And not all being about the protocols or the proposals, not being all about, you know, finding a difference between two different groups, but building a relationship, coalition building within communities. I think that's where we need to be investing.
So before we close, I wanted to get your take on some other recent comments I've seen in the news and the medical literature around the role of the HFA-containing MDIs and how they're playing a role in climate change. Just some background for our listeners is that we know that the inhalers containing CFCs were phased out of the market due to their effect on depleting the ozone layer. This was back in the 90s it started. Now, the switch to HFAs occurred as a result of that, and it didn't seem to have any effect on the ozone layer. But now we know these chemicals, which are used as propellants in these pressured metered dose inhalers, are significant greenhouse gas contributing molecules. And there are several large companies in the respiratory space who are preparing to switch to different molecules that are less greenhouse gas contributing. And this issue was addressed in an editorial in the Annals of American Thoracic Society back in July of 2022. I wondered if I could just appreciate your thoughts on this and whether you foresee any downsides to this conversion or unforeseen impacts on patient care when this happens.
I feel like caught a little bit in the here in this conversation because I very much believe that it is important that we think about the footprint that our healthcare system places, our carbon footprint, and what is our role and responsibility in reducing greenhouse gas emissions as a medical community, as hospitals. And there are so many places, you know, that where we can make an impact. So part of me thinks that, you know, there's so many big places where we can make an impact. But even this feels like a very simple thing, a simple switch that clinicians can do by switching a patient from an HFA versus to a metered dose inhaler. I think the reason why I feel somewhat conflicted is because when I think about my patients, and I think about my younger patients, it is hard.
Right.
And they are not able to generate the inspiratory volume necessary to be able to use a dry powder inhaler or to comply with the technique. Or I think of patients who have neuromuscular disease and they're not able, or even patients with severe COPD that they're not able to. So I'm a little bit concerned, and some of this is has been brought out in the recent Flovent fiasco, I call it, where, mm-hmm. you know, the switch in brand name to generic name fluticasone has led to a huge issue with getting this medication approved and covered and dispensed to some of our younger pediatric patients who just can't use dry powder inhalers. Right. And here's where I think the burden falls on insurance companies and others to really help to make it easier for us as clinicians to be able to make decisions that make the most sense for our patients. So there's one piece that I think is great and important that this podcast can help to do is to elevate this cause to the minds of clinicians who are in the prescribing seat and who do have a patient who could use a dry powder inhaler instead of an HFA and to make that switch in those patients, which honestly, it's probably the majority of the patients who that switch can be made for, and know that you would be doing a service to the environment by reducing the carbon footprint. But I'm just a teeny bit worried that if we swing the pendulum completely in that direction and we don't leave options available for our youngest patients who really, really need these medications, that we're really going to be stuck. And so that's sort of where I'm caught somewhere in the middle of all of this.
Well, I want to thank you for a lot of the perspectives you gave to us today. You know, thank you for today and also for, again, for the work you're doing with the American Lung Association.
Thank you. Thanks again for having me. This was a nice conversation.
So for our listeners who want to hear more regarding asthma, we have developed a great archive of discussions and our show feeds. And these include a talk with Dr. Payal Gupta, episode 31, Dr. Leroy Graham on episode 20, and Dr. Mario Castro on episode 13, covering various aspects of asthma. Be sure again to subscribe and rate Lungcast on your preferred listening or watching platform, and visit lung.org and hcplive.com for more news and resources. Until next time, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters.